So, welcome. My name is Michelle Combs. I'm the Manuscripts Archivist from the Special Collections Research Center at Syracuse University. I'll be your moderator today for Perspectives on Cartoons, Art, Archival Objects, and Assets. If you've noticed the cameras in the back of the room, that is C-SPAN. They're recording several sessions during the conference, and we're very pleased that they've chosen ours as one of them. So everybody behave. And try to use the word archivist as often as possible. Okay. We have three excellent presenters to fit into a one-hour session, so I will be very brief. To minimize transition time, I'm going to introduce all of our panelists at the start, and I will ask you to please hold your questions until the end. If I do my job right, we should have a little more than 10 minutes. As we've often heard in the art world, a picture is worth a thousand words. That perhaps explains why, in the archivist world, it may take a thousand words to describe one picture. And as assets, of course, some cartoons can be worth thousands of dollars. Our presenters today will speak to these three perspectives. For the art perspective, we have Martha Kennedy of the Library of Congress, one of two curators of popular and applied graphic art who are responsible for the collections of original cartoon art and other popular graphic art in the prints and photographs division. During nearly 10 years of working with these collections, Martha has curated or co-curated seven exhibitions, most featuring cartoons. With her fellow curators, she works to develop collections, preserve them, and assist scholars and others in advanced research projects. To discuss the challenges of describing cartoons in 1,000 words or less, we have Susan Klein, cartoon archivist and a colleague of mine at the Special Collections Research Center at Syracuse University, where she is responsible for a project involving the arrangement and description of more than 150 cartoonists' collections. Susan holds an MA in history from the University of Cincinnati and a BA in media communications from Webster University. Prior to her current position, she has worked as a library assistant and a graduate assistant in two other academic libraries, and she recently presented a paper on SU's editorial cartoon collections at a journalism and historians conference in New York City. Finally, we're pleased to have John Michaud, head librarian at the New Yorker magazine, where he serves on the team responsible for the digitization of many of the magazine's archival assets, including the complete New Yorker DVD, and more recently, the magazine's online digital archive. John graduated from Pratt Institute's MLIS program in 2001 and holds degrees in literature from the University of East Anglia and Lancaster University in England. Prior to working at The New Yorker, he served as metadata and taxonomy control librarian at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. We're very pleased to have all of you with us this morning. Martha, I'll let you begin.
Thank you, Michelle. Can all of you hear me all right? Great. And thank all of you for turning up early on a Saturday morning. When I was invited to join this panel and to speak about the cartoon as art, I couldn't resist taking the opportunity to show two of my favorite cartoons in the Library of Congress's collections. On the left, you see Charles Adams' cave drawings, published in The New Yorker in 1960, which is also the same year that the Guggenheim Museum opened in New York City. And on the right, you see Modern Art Museum by Anatole Kovarsky, which was published as a New Yorker cover just a few years before Adams' cartoon. These images, to me, are witty, sophisticated perspectives on art museum visits. And they are the kind of imagery that only cartoons, and they give perspectives that only cartoons can give about the subject. The library serves a vast community of users. These include members of Congress, researchers of myriad subjects on myriad levels, VIPs, school groups, family members, cultural tourists, and of course, cartoon researchers and enthusiasts. To meet these users' widely ranging needs and expectations, the library has evolved into a hybrid institution, part library, part archive, and part museum. And in the last guise, it presents exhibitions of historical and contemporary materials, and these include cartoons. I'm going to describe very briefly the library's cartoon collections, the Swan Foundation as a catalyst for cartoon research, and the library as an originator of and lender to cartoon exhibitions. The National Library has been collecting cartoons for over 100 years and has amassed an estimated 128,000 cartoon drawings and prints, consisting of satirical prints, editorial and political cartoons, comic strips, caricature, gag, or humor cartoons, comic book art, animation cells, and drawings. The holdings span 4 centuries, including early prints of the 18th and 19th century, and I show a beautiful etching by William Hogarth from the 18th century, and a 19th century print, a political print critical of President Abraham Lincoln, and then a much more recent work, comic strip by Bill Griffith, Zippy the Pinhead. And we also have some born digital work as well by the likes of Aaron Magruder. These collections, these holdings, were acquired from many sources and include copyright deposit of prints in the late 19th century, purchases, gifts from cartoonists and family members, and gift purchase agreements. The cartoons are housed in the Prints and Photographs Division, which was known originally at the library as its Department of Graphic Arts. So early on, cartoons and art closely allied. The collections are accessed through the Prints and Photographs online catalog. And I show you a slide showing the entry to the catalog, the search box, and a listing of collections. And I also list the major process collections of cartoons on the lower left. And these include the Cabinet of American Illustration, the main cartoon drawing series, and 2 other cartoon drawing series. Most recently added one is the Herb Locke collection and the Swan collection. Cartoon prints, American, and cartoon prints, British. Like our predecessors, my colleague Sarah Duke and I collect selectively for future generations. We seek to collect the best examples that we can by the best creators we know of. We weigh the importance of artistic quality and technical accomplishment of potential cartoon acquisitions, along with their capacity to communicate powerful ideas, opinions, or stories. The cartoon collections have always represented a strength of the library's graphic art collections, along with its outstanding holdings of fine prints and fine art drawings. Oops, sorry. In the 1970s, Irwin Swan, a New York advertising executive, bequeathed to the library his collection of cartoon art, along with an endowment to support the preservation, development, exhibition, and programming relating to the library's cartoon collections. The Swan Foundation for Caricature and Cartoon has been a catalyst for research in another major way, through offering an annually awarded fellowship to support scholarly graduate research in caricature and cartoon, and it is one of the few fellowships in this field. Encouraging the study of original cartoon and caricature drawings as works of art represents the heart of Irwin Swan's stated purpose in making his bequest. Recently selected Swan Fellows are doctoral candidates in art history and history, a fact that reflects increasing acceptance of cartoon art as worthy of support in the academy by art historians and historians, and even by art museums as well. Let's see. Swan Fellows research advances the critical appreciation for the art form of cartoon. And I show this slide. These are announcements of public lectures given by Swan Fellows, just to give you some idea of the breadth of topics that some of these Swan Fellows have been working on. And they include original research on the comic strip art of Winsor McCay, new perspective on the cartoons of Thomas Nast and the role of cartoons in the artistic development of abstract American painter Ad Reinhardt. A former Swan Fellow, Catherine Roeder, I show this slide of the table of contents for the 2008 issue of American Art, which is the scholarly journal published by the Smithsonian American Art Museum. And in this issue, a former Swan Fellow published an introductory essay that details the changing and rising status of comic art within the art establishment. I was privileged also to contribute an essay to this issue, which had a number of examples from the library's wonderful cartoon collections. The library has originated major cartoon exhibitions, many in recent years, and several have been accompanied by companion volumes, related publications. Both the Swan Foundation and the Herb Block Foundation mandate and support cartoon exhibitions at the library on an ongoing basis. I would just emphasize that artistic quality, technical excellence, and visual impact, as well as content, are always important criteria for curators as we make selections for these popular exhibitions. And this, in this slide, I show web pages for online versions of some of these exhibitions or images of companion volumes that were published in conjunction with them. The most recent one was Herb Block! That I co-curated with my colleague Sarah Duke, and it was a centennial celebration of Herb Block's birth. The others just mentioned briefly, Oliphant's Anthem was a major retrospective of this major cartoonist's work. Humor's Edge featured work by Ann Telnes, the second woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. Another landmark exhibition was Cartoon America in 2006 and 7, and I show the web page for the online version for it, as well as the companion volume that was published with it. And this exhibition and the book celebrate the artistic treasures from the Art Wood collection at the library. The library has also loaned prime artistic examples from its collections to museums that have mounted major or groundbreaking exhibitions of cartoon art, especially in recent years. One example I would draw your attention to is this is Masters of American Comics, which was a very high-profile, nationally touring show. It opened at LA's Museum of Contemporary Art and the Hammer Art Museum, and then traveled on to Milwaukee and to New York and Newark. The Deutsches Historisches Museum in Berlin also mounted a major exhibition in Arthur Schick. We also loaned pieces for that exhibition. And then there was another smaller but groundbreaking exhibition called Out of Sequence, which featured work by women cartoonists and African-American cartoonists, those cartoonists who tend to be have been under-recognized and underrepresented. And this was mounted by the Kraner Art Museum at the University of Illinois in 2009. I conclude by showing work by contemporary cartoonists who have transformed famous artworks of the past into cartoons that address timely themes, and they've done this with imagination and artistry. On the upper right is cartoon by Pat Oliphant entitled Waiting for Reagan from 1982, and clearly he is drawn on a famous image by Thomas Nast showing a group of vultures waiting for the storm to blow over. And on the lower right is a cartoon by Ann Telnes entitled Americans of the Decadence, which dates from 1997. And this references famous painting by French artist Thomas Couture called Romans of the Decadence from 1847. I show these examples to demonstrate the vitality, the artistically informed consciousness of cartoonists who are active today. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to thank Martha for showing some great images of cartoons to sort of set this up, because I don't have a whole lot of images of cartoons on my slides, because I'm going to talk about it from perhaps a little more dry perspective. Not too dry, but just a little different. Just to give you a little background about my presentation, you'll be getting the perspective of a special collections department in an academic research library, where cartoons are approximately 1,000 linear feet of 30,000 linear feet of materials we have. We collect a lot of popular culture topics, and cartoons is a major area of our pop culture holdings. And this is also the perspective from a two-year NHPRC grant-funded project, so that sort of influences what I'm going to be talking about. And at Syracuse, we call cartoons as an umbrella term for magazine cartoons such as The New Yorker, comic strips, editorial cartoons, and political cartoons. So why should we bother with cartoons? I think Martha did a good job of talking about their artistic value. They're also visual documents and records. They try to communicate really complex ideas in a simple format. An editorial cartoon tends to deal with very specific and complex issues and personalities, both political and social, and they really break it down into an image that you can get a quick bite of whatever they're trying to communicate to you. And a lot of editorial cartoonists consider themselves artists and journalists. They weren't just there to caricature people. They were also there to make a statement about the news. They're also a form of popular culture, as I mentioned. They use things, devices such as storytelling and narratives, the way books and movies do. There's a genre of comic strips that are sort of referred to as soap opera strips. These are a lot of detective stories and adventure-themed strips. There's one that we have in our collection that I believe I read somewhere online that in 20 years of this comic strip, they only had about 4 storylines. And I didn't read every single cartoon, so I don't know if that's really true, but I would not be surprised. So cartoons at the Special Collections, at the Special Collections Research Center at Syracuse, we have about 186 distinct collections, comic strips and panel cartoons. This is your Mutt and Jeff, your family circus type thing. Editorial cartoons, we have a wide range of people, a few Pulitzer Prize winners like Don Wright and Paul Conrad, who are still living and still actively working. We have people from a variety of political persuasions, geographical areas. We have a few sports cartoons, which are sort of a unique facet. And we also have a limited amount of correspondence proofs, fan mail, and promotional material, which is sometimes very interesting to process. And a typical collection at Syracuse is anywhere from 100 individual original artworks to 4,000 to 5,000. It's really, these collections sometimes are quite massive in size. And the great thing about the originals is that you can see what happened before they were produced in a newspaper or a magazine. You can see the notes and the changes to corrections and things that were rejected by editors on occasion. And, you know, sometimes it's sort of interesting the little historical insight you can get from the original and not what was published. So here's an example of a Sunday comic strip, just to give you a sense. This is Abby and Slats by Rayburn Van Buren, just to give you a sense of what they look like if you've never seen an original one. Editorial cartoons, this is a Paul Conrad from 1968, caricaturing Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey as Vietnam seems to be dragging down their political careers. What's one interpretation? So who are the users at a place like Syracuse, at an academic library? Well, we have a wide range of possibilities. Scholars who study rhetoric, journalism, political science, the newly established field of comic studies, art history. It's really quite unlimited. And they're great for if you're looking for illustrations of a particular topic. If you want to use sort of a non-traditional source, you know, it's a good sort of thing to look at, you know, the way different groups were portrayed in the media. And they're really popular with students. We sometimes have students come with the coordination of a subject specialist at the library, high school students will come to sort of get a glimpse of special collections, and the cartoons are very popular with them. Also, we have a lot of collectors and fans who write to us with their reference questions. We get similar questions about they have a similar piece at home and they sort of want to know what the value is. And of course, as archivists, we don't do that. There's a really large market for this type of art right now. I saw a piece by not a terribly well-known guy unless you're really into cartoons, who someone was trying to sell it on Craigslist for like $300. And I'm convinced that had Syracuse been collecting these today and trying to amass these collections, there'd be no way to do it because it would be way too expensive to buy all of this stuff. And it just wouldn't happen. Also, publishers are very involved in using our collections. There's a lot of money being made right now by doing reprints of classic strips like Peanuts. Fantagraphics is a company who's been publishing a lot of these classic strips, and they've been working with us to republish some of Prince Valiant, which we own, sort of a medieval-themed cartoon. And of course, they're always calling and asking about image permissions and copyright research for things that we own. To give you a little history of the cartoons at SCRC, they began arriving in the 60s. And it's not really clear why they decided to collect these things. They seem to have written to every cartoonist in America asking, hey, can we have your things? And some of them wrote back. And there really wasn't a lot of activity past the early 1970s. Some over time, such as Ted Key, who's had accruals. He sent stuff several times throughout his lifetime. He died in 2008, and his son is still sending us stuff fairly frequently. Processing, they were processed sort of sometimes, maybe, depending on your perspective, to put it mildly. There's some handwritten lists and inventories, which sometimes are accurate, sometimes not. Little rehousing was done. I think the people at the time just weren't sure what to do with these objects. And there were some attempts at subject arrangement, but I don't know. So if you flash forward to our NHPRC grant, we got it in 2008. It involves 2 years, one project archivist, and one student worker. The project is wrapping up this fall. And it had 4 phases. To give you just a disclaimer, I was not involved for the survey phase. I came in shortly after the arrangement and rehousing phase started. So I really had nothing to do with the survey, but I tried to get as much info as I could about it. The goals included rehousing the collections, updating and creating MARC records and EAD finding aids, updating Wikipedia entries for 30 cartoonists, tracking the use of the collections, and telling scholars and archivists and curators and anyone else who will listen that we have these hidden collections. And it's a detailed processing grant, which, as we will find out a little bit later, really influenced how this work has been playing out. So the survey phase, the goals were to really find out what we had. There's a few longtime staff members at SCRC who say, oh, there's all these cartoons, but no one really knows what's there. And it was also good to find out what type of rehousing was going to be required for these items. And one of the results, fortunately or unfortunately, as the case may be, is that there were even more hidden collections than previously realized. The amount of collections and size grew exponentially during the survey phase. And the detailed measurements that were taken were really crucial in determining rehousing needs, the types of things that we needed to order. And you also sort of got a sense of the past processing that was done or not done. One of the big work products that came out of the survey phase, which has been helpful, is a FileMaker Pro database that was created. And this is just a screenshot showing some of the fields. I'm not sure you can see it. But it sort of gets the dimensions of the items, an estimate of the amount of containers that are going to be needed, the size, any types of notes that are special about it, if it's been processed before, if there's any conservation concerns. This is just another screenshot of the database. The processing phase, in terms of the physical arrangement, has been pretty straightforward. If it has a date, you put it in date order. If it doesn't have a date, as some editorial cartoons don't have, you put it in alphabetical order. And we've been really tracking the dates in a calendar format because it really allows you to get a good glimpse of each year to see where the gaps are. You know, if someone wants to know an overview of what you have, it sort of makes it a clear way to view that. The description phase, though, became much more problematic, especially with these editorial cartoons. They're very tricky. And so one of the things was to sort of see what other people had been doing. So we looked at the few repositories, such as the Library of Congress and Ohio State. that have a lot of cartoon collections. There aren't a whole lot of people that have them, so you try to look where there are resources. There's also a few articles that have been written, particularly the indexing editorial cartoons that appeared in special libraries in 1996. It was a really interesting piece. The woman I think she was a graduate student at the time, and she sort of surveyed different entities that had cartoon collections. She called the New Yorker, I know, they're mentioned in there, and she sort of asked, what are you doing with these cartoons? How are you treating them? And it's kind of a thing where it'd be interesting if someone would follow up on this survey now and sort of see, you know, what's changed in the last decade or so. For description, all of the collections have OPAC records with links to the finding aid, Library of Congress subject headings and subdivisions, some of which you can see. And also, particular attention has been paid to getting biographical notes for obscure cartoonists. You would think in this day and age, the biographical notes may not need to be so complex because there's so much information online, and you know, if you do a Google search, something will come up. Some of these people, I don't know. I think they literally just sort of disappeared from the public purveyance, and so I had to use a lot of specialized cartoon and comics reference works, and also Who's Who in American Art was a good source that I was running down to quite frequently to write these biographies. The big question was, this is a detailed processing grant, so how detailed is detailed? It would be fabulous if we could do item-level description, but it's just not feasible. And because we're special collections and treat these as someone's archive, we try to treat them not as individual works, but as someone's body of work. You can see how someone's career and their artistic process changed from 5 to 20 years of their career. So we try to treat them as one entity, not 4,000 individual entities. And it also is influenced by format. Comic strips are pretty simple. Date inventory and stick a small description of the strip in the scope and contents note. A lot of these strips, there's a lot of information online. People can go elsewhere to really get details about it. The editorial cartoons, we also did the date inventory. And ideally, we would have item-level description with a caption, a date, and what it depicts. But then we began thinking about what type of access do people actually want for cartoons? How are people going to try to find these things to use them in their scholarly work? Is chronology enough to guide them to a particular topic? Yes and no. Some topics sort of transcend time periods. If you're looking at something that's depicting the concept of democracy, well, that could be a lot of eras. Some cartoonists, more than others, dealt with more obscure and local subjects. The Poor People's Campaign of 1968 is a good example. Paul Conrad was one of the few people, at least in our collections, who really covered that topic. And so you can't just assume that each cartoonist who worked during a particular era covered every topic, because it really depends on their newspaper and their geographical area. And there can arguments can be made for any of these approaches to try to provide description. And there was some thinking about, well, what about individual captions? But they don't really reveal much. They're pretty vague, and unless you're looking for that item, you don't know. So we decided to index the cartoons at the folder level. This is a very subjective process, as it is with any visual materials you're trying to describe. So we had to think what to index. There's sort of two approaches. What is it of, and what is it about? And to sort of muddle our way through these interpretation issues, we tried to think about what was the cartoonist's intent. Editorial cartoonists use a lot of labels. They label people and concepts and imagery just so you sort of know what they're trying to mean. And we also went with easily recognizable people. It's pretty clear when Nikita Khrushchev and Ronald Reagan are being parodied. And so to give you just a little glimpse, and I'm not going to get too technical about EAD and the finding aid process. If you have any more questions, you can ask me at the end, and you can ask Michelle. She was a big help in this. We decided to index things the way a book has indexes in the back. If you're looking for a particular subject in the back of a book, you go to the index, it tells you the page number to go to. Well, we didn't have page numbers, so we decided to create folder IDs for references to each folder. So we entered the data for each cartoon at the folder level into an Excel sheet, exported it, generated EAD tags. And basically what happens is when you see the list of the index, there's hyperlinks up to the folder description for that item. And the great thing is that later on, we could possibly export all this data and have a collection-wide index for the editorial cartoons. This is an example of what the finding aid looks like with the index. And this is some of the EAD code behind it. I won't make you read all that. And one last thing I really want to talk about is preservation. Rehousing was key with these items. It was really important to get them in a more stable condition than they were. Frankly, cartoons, though, really weren't made to last because they draw a new one every day. They don't really use techniques and materials that are meant to stay around. They do consider it art, but every day there's a deadline and they have to keep going. So we had custom clamshell comic strip boxes made, which is what the picture is of, which are really good for keeping these weirdly dimensioned things safe and not to keep them from moving around. We also used a lot of foldering to minimize the handling, so you don't have to rifle through a box of like 100 cartoons to find the one you want, so you're not touching all of them, which is very important. Some of the challenges, respecting original order. It's hard to know how some of them were processed decades ago. A lot of people don't really know what had been done to these, and it wasn't documented very well. The scale of the project, what can we do in 2 years? We're still sort of struggling to make sure this thing gets done. It's going to get done, but it's hard sometimes to know what you can do in 2 years when you discover all this new material during the survey process. Tracking down obscure cartoonists. This is where the fan community really helped. There's a lot of good blogs and databases that fans have put online. And you know what? More often than not, they're right. And some of the other sources aren't right. These people know. There's a guy whose name is, I can't remember his last name. His first name's Alan. And he has what's called the Stripper's Guide, which is sort of an interesting blog. You should look at it. And then there's the calls to just digitize them all, just put them all online, all however many thousand there are. And it's really not that easy because there's a complex maze of rights holders, of artists and syndicates, and I'm not even sure how that works sometimes. So finally, the outreach and results part. We put in some Wikipedia links, and we're still doing that and making some contributions. It adds credibility to Wikipedia as a scholarly source. It also brings us a lot of traffic and gives greater exposure to our collections. And, adds to the history of these people. There's a lot of cartoonists who I think personally deserve entries and don't have them just because people don't know who they are. But if they knew who they were, they could really get to these resources. It's also brought in additional accessions from previous donors who've called us up 40 years later and said, hey, I want to send more stuff, like 5 boxes of unopened fan mail. And other people who have collected cartoons have sort of sent us additional single items. They've said, hey, I got one of those in my basement. My dad got it from so-and-so, and so we're going to send it to you, okay? And unplanned, we've had an exhibition and a symposium planned during homecoming with a couple alumni cartoonists. And also there's going to be a preservation lecture with a conservator from the Library of Congress who's coming in October. And these are things that we didn't know were going to happen when this project started. And the best result is no more cartoon backlog. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Unlike the other members of this panel, The New Yorker is still in the business of publishing cartoons, and also it is a profit-making business owned by Condé Nast, so there is a financial aspect to it. We are in the business of making money. So I'm going to address how indexing and archiving cartoons at The New Yorker is involved in both its editorial process and in the process of marketing and merchandising materials from the magazine. So first, a little history. The magazine has been published weekly since 1925, give or take the occasional double issue. And in that time, we published more than 4,000 issues. We have published more than 250,000 cartoons. We're most famous for our single panel cartoons, such as this recent cartoon by Carolita Johnson. We also have published, of course, many multi-panel cartoons, such as this Otto Soglo cartoon from 1931. And we also do some color cartoons, though these are much less frequent. And this is a Gay and Wilson from earlier this year. So what I'd like to do is just talk you through the process of the sort of lifespan of a cartoon at the magazine. So each week, cartoonists send in hundreds of cartoons. They either mail them in, they fax them in, or they bring them in person and present them to our cartoon editor, Robert Mankoff, Cartoonists who have a long association with the magazine and who live in the New York area actually bring their cartoons in person. There's a lounge in the magazine. You can see it's very well appointed. But there's a little lounge in the cartoon department where cartoonists come and wait to have an audience with the cartoon editor. Here are two current cartoonists, Eric Hilgert and Sam Gross, who were in last Tuesday waiting to show their work to Bob. Here's another cartoonist, Farley Katz. And you may recognize Farley because he was most likely the model for the gentleman in this cartoon. The cartoonists at the magazine all know each other, and those who come in to present their work on Tuesdays then go out to lunch together. So, and throughout the history of the magazine, there are these kind of references to other cartoons buried in the cartoon. So it's just a sort of thing that goes on between them. So Bob selects from the hundreds of cartoons that come in each week, he selects 40 or 50 of them, and he takes them to a closed-door meeting with David Remnick. That's David Remnick's office there. And they go through those cartoons, and from that they generally approve of 25 to 30, which they intend to buy for the magazine. But before those cartoons can be purchased, they're brought to the library where I work, and what we do is we check the cartoons that have been selected against our index to make sure that we haven't published anything similar or identical in the past. And so what I would do is when a cartoon is brought in, this is a Alex Gregory cartoon that was purchased last week, is I handwrite on the cartoon some keywords to search on. The keywords, the controlled vocabulary for our print index was established in 1933 by when the library was created, and it was established by two librarians, Ebba Johnson and Helen Stark, and they put into place the procedures that we still use today in the magazine. For example, and we use them consistently, so today we use automobiles rather than cars, we use prize fighters rather than boxers, and my favorite, we use beatniks for any kind of counterculture person from a punk to to a slacker. But so there's there's lots of quirks to the controlled vocabulary, but at least it's consistent. And so the cartoons are checked against our index. This is what the index looks like. These are actual paper volumes that we update, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Now, the goal is to find previous cartoons that are similar to or identical to ones that have just been purchased. Usually we do, sometimes we don't. So here's a George Price from 1973. You'll see the husband who's put out for sale at a tag sale. This is Paul Karasik from 2008. The husband's been put out with the recycling. And this is a Bruce Eric Kaplan cover from 2010 where the husband has been put out with the trash. So we don't catch them all. And our readers are sometimes better at this than we are, and we get letters pointing out the slips. But we do catch most of them. So after we check the cartoons against our index, the cartoon is then published. The lag time between a cartoon being purchased and a cartoon being published can be anywhere from a week to several months. It depends how timely it is. It depends if it's geared to a certain season. But when the cartoon is published, then it can be indexed. So once it's published, we take the issue, we go back to our cartoon index, and we use the keywords that we originally used to search the cartoon to check it against the archive. And we then write up a description of each cartoon with bibliographic information, And we print these out. We write them up in a Word document. We print these out, and we actually apply an adhesive backing to the pages, and we cut the strips out and put them into our index. So this is a page from our index. This is the subject, under the subject, mustache. So you can see the Carolita Johnson cartoon that I've been showing is in here, and you can see there are previous cartoons from the last few years by Paul Noth and Sam Gross. So this was originally typewritten in the 30s, 40s, 50s, but now we actually use a word processor. Now, I don't want you to think that we only use 19th century technology at The New Yorker. This is the 21st century. So we also have a very robust FileMaker database that is hosted by our editorial assets department. This database has its origins in the Cartoon Bank, which Bob Mankoff started in the 90s, and that was a pooling of resources of all the cartoonists at The New Yorker to gather their materials together and to increase their ability to market and to make money from cartoons after they were published in the magazine. So that ended up being the origin of this database, and the database was increased in the early 2000s when Bob headed a project to scan every cartoon that ever appeared in the magazine. So we now have a record for every cartoon that ever appeared in the magazine with the scan, with metadata. And so this database, in addition to the keywords that were used for the paper index, also includes a great deal of additional information, sales information. It includes additional keywording, so it would have cars instead of automobiles, it would have punk instead of beatnik and things like that. And it would also have keywording geared towards selling it. So if people are looking for things for Father's Day, Mother's Day, Christmas, that kind of thing would be in there too. Now this database is used to feed the New Yorker store, which is a website where you can purchase prints of the cartoon. Here's the Carolita Johnson cartoon that we saw earlier. You can get it in different sizes, in different mats, things like that. We also sell products. So, t-shirts. You can't see the cartoons, but we have refrigerator magnets. This is a wine bag. Greeting cards, mugs. My colleague in the library, Aaron Overby, and I, we are actually involved in the editorial process for these products. So they go through an approvals process to make sure that the quality is up to what we'd hope for a New Yorker product. But what happens to the original cartoon, the one that was submitted to Bob and that was printed in the magazine? The original artwork goes to the Condé Nast archive, which is managed by my colleague, Sean Waldron, who's here in the audience today. These are the binders where the original art is kept. And that original art is actually for sale. Here is the original artwork of the Carolita Johnson cartoon I showed earlier. And you can purchase this, and we have a woman who represents the artists for sale of original art. And that art is also available for licensing for all kinds of different products and for PowerPoint presentations such as this one. So they really do try to maximize the different ways that they can bring in money for the cartoonists from their work. So thank you very much.
On time, so we do have time for some questions. I understand the process is that you ask your question and I have to summarize it, so I'm going to ask you to please be concise if you would. So questions for our presenters. Yes.
Hi, my question is mostly for the first two panelists.
Okay, so the question is, when treating cartoons as art objects or as archival objects, how do we maintain the connection to the venue in which they were originally published, and is that something that researchers are often interested in?
Well, I don't do a lot of the public services side of this, but from talking to a few scholars and whatnot, a lot of scholars aren't interested in the original art, unfortunately. They would rather read a digitized newspaper in which an editorial cartoon was printed, which I can kind of understand because you could get the context of what is also on the page, but I find it sort of sad at times because you don't really get to see, you're not going to the purest form of a cartoon if you're only looking at it when it was published. So I think that, you know, I think if I was doing the research, if I was the scholar, I would be picky and want to look at both. I'd want to see the originals, but I'd also want to look at it in the context of the paper, if that answers your question.
I would say that from my experience in helping researchers, a lot of them are very interested in publication information. And in our records in the library's online catalog, we try to include publication information whenever we have it. And we're always interested in adding it if we are able to obtain it later, too. So we're very interested in helping to establish the original context. Thank you.
Yes?
Let me repeat real quick, since we're being recorded. The question is, the way that the New Yorker is tracking the subject headings or the keyword terms, and the question is, what's the purpose in maintaining both the physical binders and the online database?
Well, two reasons. One reason is that those binders are still the best way to serve as an editorial check against repeating ourselves. It's much easier to look up old cartoons for that purpose with those binders than to use a database, in part because that controlled vocabulary was created with that purpose in mind, so it's part of the editorial process. The other reason is that it's permanent and it goes back to 1933 and it's kind of institutional repository, and you know, if the power goes out, we always have that. You know, if the databases go down, we always have that print index. And I should say that in addition to those print binders, we also have scrapbooks with every single cartoon cut and pasted into them.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, both.
So the question is regarding the copyright for cartoons that are purchased by the New Yorker, particularly in regards to the original art that then goes on to be for sale.
Both prints and the original art are for sale, and I think even after the original, if the original art is sold, that prints and potentially T-shirts and reprints are available through the website. Now, the cartoonists all belong to the Cartoon Bank, which is a collective that was created. They have the option of opting out of the Cartoon Bank and managing their own rights. But the Cartoon Bank is a sort of collective that allows them to pool their resources and to have the benefit of, you know, Condé Nast's marketing division and also legal resources and other things. And in fact, one of the things that the Cartoon Bank, now our editorial assets division, does is they actually seek out jobs and work for the cartoonists. Perhaps advertisers want a cartoonist to draw for them so that they would find additional work for them to supplement their income.
Okay. Yes, back there. Okay, so the question is that sort of a requirement for cartoonists when the New Yorker purchases their work, do they have to agree to these other uses of their work and to participating in this bank?
It's a negotiation with each cartoonist. They negotiate their contract with the magazine and with the rights issues pertaining to the cartoon after it's published in the magazine.
Yes. And the question is regarding sales of other products with the cartoonist's work. What kind of residuals do they get? I think that question might be coming from a cartoonist, perhaps. No? Okay. Just checking.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the percentages and the amounts are, but they do earn money when their work is reused. That is the goal of doing that, is to give them additional income and additional income for the company as well.
Yes, in the back.
That's one of the rights thing actually for all the panelists. Since there are few repositories that are managing, how many questions do you have about the other side, about licensing with fair use? People who want to use cartoons in educational contexts, do you find yourself getting those questions, answering them? How do you interpret their needs and involve them?
Okay, so turning from the profit angle to the nonprofit, the question is, How many requests do each of you get for fair use uses of the work? Is that a frequent thing? And how do you judge whether it's appropriate fair use?
We definitely get requests. It's hard for me to put a number on it, but pretty often during the course of a year. And as part of the Prints and Photographs Division's web pages, we have an extensive series of rights information. And there's general information on how to establish the right status of a pictorial work. And there's also a listing of creators and organizations that hold rights for cartoons and other works in the collection. And a lot of these entries give direct contact information for the rights holders. It's an ongoing process. It's a work in progress. We're always trying to add to it. But we give whatever information we have.
We get a lot of requests to print them, and I would assume probably for what some people would consider fair use. I don't think that we interpret fair use for them. That's not our job. We try to give them any information we have. We also require that they cite that the image is coming from us, if it's something we physically own. So we pretty much say, you need to cite us, but you have to also contact the rights holder, and we try to help them find that person. We don't always have info. There's a few people who, you know, it says the rights are held by Roy Crane's nieces. Well, no one knows who his nieces are, and, you know, that's the record that was kept since he donated it, and so we sort of say, well, if you think that's fair use to use them when you can't find his nieces, then go for it.
For both articles and cartoons, we have a rights and permissions department that handles those requests, and that they would, on case by case, determine whether it would be fair use or whether there would be rights issues involved. So yeah, we have a team of people who handle those requests.
Could I just add one thing? I meant to also say that we do ask people seeking to reproduce works in our in the library's collections to give a credit line, you know, to indicate we have sort of a standard format credit line. Although the library doesn't formally grant permission for use of images in its collections, I mean, that's something that we do request, and in addition to sharing the rights information.
Yes.
This question is for Susan. You're talking about the Wikipedia entries. How do you try and incorporate, especially with, I was wondering if you could talk more about that, but especially if there's an already pretty good
So the question is for Susan regarding her participation in enhancing cartoonist articles in Wikipedia. How do you go about that?
Well, I think the one thing about the cartoonists on Wikipedia is that a lot of them are stub articles. So there's the opportunity to, if you have biographical information on someone who doesn't have a lot online, you can use it as a chance to really use your primary sources that provide biographical information for that cartoonist to help expand the article so it is no longer classified as a stub. I think that's a big way to do it. There's a lot of sections in cartoonist articles and for comic strips about the style and the genre, and I don't get into that too much because it's just kind of time-consuming to try to, you know, figure out how to phrase that, and it's sort of very... I think the purpose is more for us is the goal is to show people, you know, to flesh out more of this history of these cartoonists so people can find the resources, and that's why we add the links. And I try not to add links to ones that, unless we are like one of the sole repositories for that person. There's a few that it'd be nice to stick a link into, but when you only have 100 of their cartoons and someone in another state has 4,000 of them, I don't really want to add a link to that because it's sort of, you know, we're not going to be able to help them as much as the other place probably.
And I'll just expand on that just a little bit because I've also participated in this process for a number of our other collections in addition to our cartoonists. And one of your questions was about how do you insinuate yourself, which I like that phrasing. There, in every Wikipedia article, or in many of them, there is a section called external links, I believe it's called. And there was a big debate within the Wikipedia community last year about whether or not inserting links to archival collections counted as spam, because the theory was it would draw traffic to your site, therefore you could ask for more money, therefore it was sort of like advertising. And after much discussion, the Wikipedia policy actually was changed, and links to archival collections are now permitted in that section. And so if the article's really good and we can't really make it any better, we'll just add a little link to our material in that external links collection, assuming, as Susan said, we have a substantial amount. We don't try to get in everywhere. Okay, yes. So the question for Martha and for Susan is, what challenges are there in continuing to collect the work of living cartoonists who are still actively working?
I would say that it varies with each cartoonist. We have entered into some short-term deposit agreements with some cartoonists, not with very many. A number of them seem to be willing to give an outright gift for a limited number of pieces. And, you know, once we have the rights status and so on, those kinds of questions answered, the kind of information they would like to have posted on the website and so on, it seems to work out pretty well. Does that answer your question?
To be honest, we haven't, I've only been there a year, but from what I know, we have not done a lot of collecting of cartoonists actively since the early 1970s. And there were a few at the time, such as Ted Key, who died recently and whose family is still sending stuff. Some of the stipulations a few of them have put on their collection is that there can be no reproductions made unless there's this really specific permission granted from the family. Like, they have a real interest in trying to make money still off of this work. And I suspect that if Syracuse was trying to amass these collections today, I suspect the donor agreements would be much more tricky to navigate. Because at the time, it seems like a lot of people didn't really see the value in this art. I think newspapers didn't really care what their cartoonists did with it. They said, hey, here's this art. Give us another one the next day. Take it to your closet. Take it to your basement. We don't care. And so I think now my assumption is that a lot of cartoonists are probably safeguarding their work a little bit more because there is that monetary value.
Okay, it looks like we are just about out of time. I'd like to thank all of you for your questions and for engaging with our presenters. I also want to mention that, like all the other sessions in this time slot, we had to shrink ours from 90 minutes to 60, so our presenters had to cut ruthlessly. And if you have a question you didn't get a chance to ask, or if you want a closer look at the New Yorker swag, and I believe Martha has some cartoon bookmarks from the Library of Congress, so please come up afterwards, and I'm sure they'd love a chance to talk with you. And let's give another round of applause for our presenters. Thank you.